was reading this book, Limits to Growth, which was published in 1972. I was 21 years old at the time, and it changed my life. I realized for the first time in my young life that society was on an unsustainable path. And so I've spent the last 40 years or so figuring out why that is, how we got into this situation, where we're going from here. Basically, the Limits to Growth study carried out by some MIT scientists was an effort to use computers to model the likely interactions between population growth, resource depletion, and environmental impacts. And the standard run scenario showed a peak in decline in world industrial output sometime in the early 21st century. Of course, mainstream economists thought this was a horrible thing that they would come to such a conclusion, so there must be something wrong with the study. And these days, if you hear about limits to growth, you'll typically hear about that it was debunked long ago, which is definitely not the case. Recent retrospective analysis has shown that the most pessimistic of the scenarios in the study, the standard run scenario, is tracking actual real-time data quite closely. So what I want to do over the next 16 minutes, hopefully, is explain to you how I think this is coming together in real time, how we're experiencing the limits to growth, and I'm going to talk about it in terms of energy, debt, and climate. Starting with energy, because energy is the most important thing in the world. Without energy, nothing happens. And energy is at the core of economic growth. Basically, before the fossil fuel revolution, we used energy primarily from food crops and firewood, and we exerted energy into our environment to get what we wanted and needed by way of muscle power. All that changed when we discovered how to use coal, oil, and natural gas, and how to extract them in large amounts. Think about it this way. Maybe you run out of gas in your car and had to push your car 10 feet off to the side of the road. That's hard work, right? Car is a big, heavy thing. Imagine pushing your car 20 or 30 miles. How much work would that be? Well, depending on how big you are and how big your car is, let's say a couple of months of hard work. Well, we get that done for us, our car getting pushed 20 or 30 miles by a single gallon of gasoline for which we're paying $3 and change. So 2 months hard human labor for less than $4, that's incredibly cheap energy. And it's dense and portable energy. It's really, really useful. It's the equivalent of magic compared to what we were able to do before. We've effectively discovered buried treasure, a huge trove of buried treasure, and we've gone on a spending spree over the course of the last few decades. This is what the oil industry looked like back in the 1930s. This is what it looks like today. So technology has been applied to the process of energy production. And on the other side of the coin, having all of this dense, portable energy cheaply available to us has been a spur to technological development. We found more and more ways of using that energy, very often to replace human labor. You know, it costs so much more to hire a person to use muscle power in so many instances than it does to use a fossil fuel machine to do the same thing. But of course, fossil fuels have a couple of problems, one of which, of course, is that burning them changes the climate. We'll talk about that in a moment. The other problem is that they are non-renewable, finite resources. So as we extract them, we are in the process of running out. Now, of course, we're not about to literally run out of oil, coal, and natural gas anytime soon. But nevertheless, we've extracted them using the low-hanging fruit principle, the best first principle. So the easiest, cheapest, highest quality fuels are extracted first, and then we go from there. So this this problem of depleting resource quality or declining resource quality is impacting oil first and foremost, and oil just happens to be the most important of the fossil fuels from an economic standpoint because virtually all of our transportation depends upon oil, and transportation in turn is at the heart of trade. So the global economy essentially runs on oil, and over the last 10 years, something has happened in the petroleum world. Effectively, cheap oil has gone away, and the rate of extraction of regular conventional oil has flatlined. We have seen some increases in oil production recently, but it's all been in the unconventional category. That's tar sands up in Canada, or light tight oil in the Bakken Formation in North Dakota produced by fracking, or ultra deep water oil from the Gulf of Mexico, and so on. We've hit a point of declining returns on investments in production of oil, exploration and production of oil. As I said, the oil world is fundamentally changing, and the price of oil is another symptom of that, because whereas 10 or a dozen years ago, all of the responsible agencies like the International Energy Agency were predicting that today we'd have oil priced around $25 to $30 a barrel. Instead, it's been up around $100 a barrel until just the last 3 months or so, when it's taken a nosedive for reasons that unfortunately I can't explain in 16 minutes. Temporarily declining prices don't solve the underlying problem. Because the underlying problem is that the industry actually needs even higher prices above $100 a barrel to go out and look for and produce more of the tar sands, ultra heavy oil from Venezuela, ultra deep water oil, and so on. But society can't pay more. That's really why the price is dropping. Demand is decreasing because the economy is weakening. So people unfortunately don't understand these underlying dynamics. Instead, we hear the advertising messages about the wonders of hydrofracturing, light tight oil, shale gas. Now we have 100 years of cheap gas, we're told by the industry. We at Post Carbon Institute wanted to track down the real story here, so we've hired out the data on over 80,000 currently producing shale gas and tight oil wells, and looked at the location of each well, the initial production rates, the evolution of production over time. What's the real geology here? And what we found is that this is basically a bubble. It's a very short-term flash in the pan. We know this because individual wells decline so fast, typically 70% in the first year. So the industry has to drill and drill and drill thousands of wells each year in order to keep production from crashing. And that's what they've been doing. It's been heroic rates of drilling that have created shale gas and tight oil boom. But there are only so many places to drill. And our analysis suggests this is the peak will happen within probably the next couple of years for both shale gas and tight oil. It's all downhill from there. This is what the tar sands look like. The problem is, as we move to lower grade resources and have to apply more sophisticated technology, not only does the price go up, but the environmental impacts and risks increase exponentially. This is a great way of visualizing the whole situation with the resource pyramid. We've been extracting conventional resources up at the top of the pyramid, and you'll hear that there's immense amounts of coal, oil, and natural gas still underground, and that's absolutely true. As I said earlier, we're not about to run out. But we get to we start at the top of the pyramid and drill our way down, and as we do so, we get to certain limits. We're at the price technology limit right now, where we know there's a lot more oil out there, but the price isn't high enough to pay for the technology that would be needed to get the rest of that oil. And then just below that price technology limit, which is where we are with petroleum today, is the energy in equals energy out limit, where it would actually take a barrel of oil's worth of energy to go out and find and produce that next incremental barrel of oil. So at that point, oil may still be a useful lubricant or chemical feedstock, but it ceases to be an economic source of energy. And you'll note that most of the resource is below that energy in, energy out limit. So yes, again, plenty of resources there, but it's almost irrelevant. Important principle, energy return on energy investing. One of the magic features of fossil fuels was that in the early days, it only took a trivial amount of energy to drill an oil well or pull coal out of the ground or natural gas compared to the amount of energy that we got through that process. That energy return ratio is declining. This is very seldom talked about, very little understood, generally speaking, certainly by economists, but it's at the heart of economic growth. This is the economy back in 1970. This is the economy that we're going to be facing in, say, 2030. Much higher energy inputs to yield at the lower end of the diagram you see, you know, consumption, staples, and discretionary. That's what the economy is all about, right? And in 1970, it didn't take much to produce a big payoff. That payoff is going to decline. Okay. Debt, second category. We're talking about energy, technology, and money here. Money seems to make the world go round, but it's all based on energy. Early in the 20th century, our biggest problem from an economic standpoint was overproduction. With all of this cheap energy and some new technologies like the powered assembly line, it was possible to make stuff in much greater quantities than people were accustomed to buying it. So solutions, advertising, as Jerry was talking about, whole new industry. And of course, as time went on, advertising messages became much more sophisticated. The purpose, of course, was to persuade people to want stuff that they didn't realize they wanted. But that wasn't enough, because at that time, in the early 20th century, most people bought stuff with cash. And new technological products like the automobile were too expensive for most people to pay cash for, so we needed something else, consumer credit. We needed it to be possible for people to consume now and pay later. So over the course of the 20th century, consumer credit grows and grows and grows. We reach a turning point in the 1980s with globalization, a couple of important technological innovations. Computer monitoring of inventory, satellite communications, and container ships make it possible for workers on the other side of the planet now to compete with workers in American factories. So U.S. hourly wages go flatline. But by this point, we've become addicted to growth. We've created a consumer society. Consumerism is not just a perverse predilection of individual Americans. It's a system by this time. It's a system that is ingrained in our banking system, even our monetary system. So how do we keep that growth-based consumerist system growing? Well, at this point, we've got to increase debt, because we can't do it just with increasing wages for consumption. Consumer spending by this time is 70% of the economy. We have to keep people spending more, but they're not making more money, so how do we do it with more debt? And so starting in the 1970s and 80s, debt begins growing at a much higher rate than the economy as a whole. We can do this with debt-based currency, and we've been doing it famously. And I'm not talking about government debt here. I'm talking about consumer debt, corporate debt, debt within the financial industry, as well as government debt. And this is basically what's happening. As you can see, in 2008, we seem to have hit the limits to debt, at least in this country, and really most countries around the world. And since then, debt in most categories has not been growing so much. So government has stepped in as the borrower and lender of last resort, the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury and the Congress and all. And now everyone perceives this as being a huge problem. But actually, it goes much deeper than that. money is something that is a human invention. It's we can create it out of nothing. But nevertheless, there are rules and norms within the system of finance and money, and those are frayed. Coming apart. We've reached some inherent limits. They're not as important, though, as the limits we're reaching with regard to the environmental impacts of burning fossil fuels. And here, you already, I'm sure, know the story. I won't even tell it to you. As we burn coal, oil, and natural gas, carbon dioxide, at least in the atmosphere, the result is global warming. Why does this impact economic growth? Well, if we were to really do something about climate change, what would be entailed is dramatically and rapidly reducing our combustion of fossil fuels. But our economy runs on fossil fuels. So if we had decades and decades to do this, maybe conceivably we could do it without impacting the economy that much. But we've got to do it really fast. And the replacements for fossil fuels, they're really good. I'm a big advocate of solar and wind. We need lots more of them. But they're not going to drive the kind of economic growth that we saw during the early 20th century. So in a way, it doesn't matter what we do about climate change. If we don't do anything about it, then the costs of climate change to the economy will increase and increase to the point where they make further economic growth no longer possible as seas rise and coastal cities are inundated, as crops fail, and so on. Or if we choose to stop climate change in its tracks by dramatically reducing fossil fuel consumption, in that case as well, economic growth is basically over. So we have this sort of pincer effect from several different directions. All of these trends are telling us one thing, that the party's over. And in some ways that's a good thing, because the party hasn't been equally distributed, for one thing. It's been extremely unequal in terms of the world's population. Just a tiny proportion of world's people have benefited enormously, while lots of other people have seen their lives negatively impacted by all of this. And then, of course, the rest of the natural world, we just learned half the world's animals over the course of the last 40 years as a result of economic growth, production, consumption, and so on. So we're on this train that's speeding up and speeding up. The only thing we care about is that it's going faster this year than it was last year. That's the only measure of success in our world, economic growth. And meanwhile, we face problems. So I'm not going to try and wrap this all up in a nice, neat, happy package for you. We have the rest of the weekend to talk about this conundrum. All I hope to do in this short talk is frame the situation. And so we have a lot to think about and talk about in the next few hours. I'm glad to hear what you do.